From PRI, Public Radio International in Los Angeles, I'm Tavis Smiley. On today's program, we're revisiting some of our favorite conversations. Environmentalist and Texas resident Dr. Robert Bullard shares his experiences of Hurricane Harvey. Then Sheriff Greg Champagne of the organization Fight Crime Invest in Kids discusses the importance of early education and after-school programs on a child's well-being as part of our Road to Health series. And legendary folk singer Judy Collins talks about her latest projects, which include a CD called A Love Letter to Stephen Sondheim. But first, the Trump White House announced it will roll back DACA, the program that protects undocumented immigrants who entered the U.S. as children from deportation. Our first guest, John Nichols, says rescinding DACA has been a priority for Attorney General Jeff Sessions all along. He also says that Sessions is one of a few people running the government under Trump. Nichols shares his insights in his latest text. It's called Horsemen of the Trumpocalypse, a field guide to the most dangerous people in America. Can I just tell you, I'm glad I got that title out without messing it up.
There have been a few people who struggled with it.
Yeah.
When you're trying to create a new word, and you're trying to combine a little biblical principle with a little politics, it's sometimes rough initially.
I said it once. I ain't going to try to say it again.
I got it out
one time. No laughing matter here. How surreal was it? I even saw that President Obama, who hasn't said much since he left the White House, mm-hmm. went on his Facebook page to sound off on this move.
He promised that he would.
He kept his word. Mm-hmm. So President Obama sounded off on this announcement by the White House, by Mr. Trump, that he's rescinding the DACA provisions. What do you make of this?
I think it's what Jeff Sessions and a few of these people wanted to do long ago, long before Trump even became a presidential candidate. And they attached themselves to Trump early on because they saw him as a vehicle to do this. It is tragic. It is irresponsible. Jeff Sessions in his press conference was dishonest. He suggested that these remarkable young people are taking jobs from American workers when in fact immigration is a net boon to our economy. It's good for us. Yep. And he said a lot of other things that were incredibly irresponsible and wrongheaded. But I'm not surprised because after Jeff Sessions' nefarious tenure as a U.S. attorney, in Alabama, his actions as regards civil rights and voting rights down there, when he was turned down for a federal judgeship.
That's right.
He remade himself politically, came back into politics, ultimately became a U.S. senator, and sort of changed his game just a little to being this militant anti-immigration, anti-immigrant rights player. And so when he was up there, I think, I don't want to get in his head, I don't try to do that, but I would suggest to you that he was realizing a arc that he got on a long time ago, and we should not lose sight of that. He will not let go of this. He will be very hardcore on it. There will continue to be a struggle over this issue, and what's encouraging is that I'm hearing Republicans in Congress, people who, unlike Jeff Sessions, are looking a little bit to the future, who are saying that there may be some resistance there, and I certainly hope so, because boy, this is so divisive.
What's ironic to me about this, John, I'm sure it's not lost on you either, is that these guys were at each other's throats. I mean, Sessions, of course, couldn't say what he wanted to say publicly, the way that Trump sort of dissed him publicly and on his tweets, etc. But here they are now again, apparently in lockstep on this issue.
Well, this is what's troubling. One of the things to understand, and I write a lot about this in the book because it's one of the lost realities of the Trump administration. There are power centers within this administration.
Yeah.
And Jeff Sessions is a power center. Mm-hmm. He is, even though the president was upset with him about some of the Russia stuff, the reality is that Jeff Sessions comes with a constituency built up over many decades, and that constituency advocates for an incredibly intolerant view. Not just on immigration, but on a host of issues. And I'll remind you also that, you know, for all the talk about divisions between Sessions and Trump, Sessions' longtime aide, Stephen Miller, is still in the White House and, by all accounts, still very central to a lot of these discussions.
Yeah. I loved how you opened the book. First of all, I love the dedication to your mom and to her friends. You have to read the dedication. It's worth the price of the book, just the dedication.
Thank you.
I love that. But then I love the next part of the book where you actually give a user's guide for how to actually use a book. Because the first question I had, okay, so John's going to tell us who these people are that are really running things behind the scenes, but how do we use this book? What do we do with this?
Well, I have always argued that this president came to this position without a lot of political experience. He had entertainment experience, and the way our politics is evolving, that was useful. But he didn't know much about governance.
That's charitable when you say without a lot. He had none.
Right. And he didn't know yeah. the players.
Yeah.
Right? So here he is trying to put together an administration. And it became very clear to me very early on that, he gave jobs to people who were the loudest yellers in the room. It wasn't the people who had the deepest experience or the insights or the nuance. So first and foremost, I think it's really important for people to understand why these people are where they are. They're not there because they're the best at it.
Got it.
They're there because they yelled loudest, because they had the most money behind them, they had the most connections with the hard right. His real strong conservatives will tell you this is the most right-wing administration in history. Mm-hmm. It isn't just a Trump administration. It goes ideologically. So I want people to understand that. But I also want to understand those who seek to resist this administration, those who object, that to simply obsess about Donald Trump, about his latest tweet, about his horrible press conferences, whatever else upsets you about Donald Trump, is insufficient. It is insufficient because we now have a cabinet system of governments, nothing like what Washington or the founders imagined. Mm-hmm. They had tiny cabinets. This is large. These are multi-billion dollar agencies with thousands of staffers and huge internal power to give executive orders, to change rules. And thus, my argument for how to use this book is to learn who these people are, learn who objects to them, who's following them, and if you've got a passion on issues of war and peace or the environment or civil rights or housing or whatever other issue, expand your focus beyond Donald Trump to the people he has empowered, often to act in our name but without our informed consent.
Let me put you on the spot here. We know the names of some of these generals, field generals, that we should keep our eye on because we see them every day. We see Jeff Sessions every day. We see Mr. Tillerson at State every day. So some of these, we see Mattis every day. So some of these guys we see every day. Give me a couple of people who we don't necessarily see every day, but they're putting some serious strings.
Oh, I'll start off with one that's central to what's been happening of late.
Okay.
Elaine Chao. She's the wife of Mitch McConnell. She's been a member of previous administrations. Her record at the Department of Labor back during the Bushers was a terrible record. It faced many objections, much criticism, not just from unions, but from people who analyze how you run a government agency. Mm-hmm. But she's back. Now she's running transportation. And we don't pay a lot of attention to the Department of Transportation. We tend to think of it as just, you know, make sure that the planes go and buses go. That is such a powerful agency as regards our safety, as regards spending of money. Donald Trump is talking about a $1 trillion infrastructure program. Very real possibility that a lot of that will be run through the Department of Transportation, but not in the way that a Franklin Roosevelt did, more with privatization, a lot of corporations coming out with more money than they've ever had. You really need to look at her, and you need to look at her for one other reason, too. When Donald Trump had that horrible press conference on Charlottesville,
she was standing there.
Right behind.
Yeah, exactly.
Do you know why she was standing there? Because that press conference wasn't supposed to be about Charlottesville. It was supposed to be about
infrastructure.
And they were announcing that they were overturning a order by Barack Obama called the Federal Flood Risk Management Standard. That standard,
as Harvey's on the way.
It was a little bit before. They didn't quite see the weather. I don't think they would have done it if they'd known what was coming. But that standard said, because we're seeing such bigger storms, bigger storm surges, more flooding, we think it's related to climate change, and we think we're going to have more of this in the future, we need to make sure that when we spend money on infrastructure, to build a bridge, to build a road, to build a hospital, whatever we're putting the money into, that it be climate resilient, that it be ready for the next kinds of storms that are coming. Just days before Harvey, they overturned that rule.
Yeah.
Now, as we rebuild after Harvey, and it will be a massive rebuilding, one of the critical rules to make sure that if the next storm comes, what we build will stand, has been taken off the books. Why was it taken off the books? Not because good fiscal conservatives wanted it off the books. This was crony capitalism.
How much damage can they do, assuming they have, best case scenario, 4 years, worst case scenario, 8 years? How much damage can they really do?
They can transform America. And that's why I came up with the word Trumpocalypse.
Yeah.
We all understand the biblical concept of the apocalypse.
Sure.
And some people are afraid of that with Donald Trump. They fear him, as they say, having his finger on the button. And of course, I don't, you know, detract from that concern. I read a lot about the generals and the military and these issues in here. But my concept of a Trumpocalypse is that if you take the worst of Donald Trump, the things that most unsettle us, this religious intolerance, this reopening of old wounds, this comfort level with a sort of an amorphous view toward the battle between racists and those who oppose racism, all of these things And what if that became America? Well, it won't be Donald Trump that does that. If we have this transition, this transformation, it will be the people he has empowered, the people he has put in cabinet positions and advisory positions, and also the people outside the administration who he gives voice to and gives connection to. And that transformation could reverse decades, our entire lifetimes. It could reverse the progress that we've made. And as a country, we can't afford that.
My time is running out here, but I just read a piece. Your colleague at The Nation, Joan Walsh,
yes,
wrote a piece, and I'm going to mess the title up, but her piece basically was Why Pence is Worse Than Trump.
Mm-hmm.
If I hear you correctly, for those who believe that Pence is worse than Trump, it sounds like you don't really need Mike Pence if these people are doing what you say they're doing.
That's exactly right. I mean, with all due respect, I write about Pence in here. Yeah. I write about Paul Ryan and Mitch McConnell. I write about all these players. But with all due respect, Donald Trump has empowered people at agencies and in places we don't even pay attention to, like overseeing banking, overseeing environmental protection, overseeing all sorts of major, major aspects of our lives. And as long as they are there, as long as they're doing their bidding, even if at the end of the day, Donald Trump were to take a month off and just lie in bed and not even tweet, right? Not do anything, just take the month off, awful things would be happening and a deconstruction of the regulatory state and really of America as we want it to be would continue because of these people who, frankly, much of the media are rarely even covered.
Sleep on that tonight. Horseman of the Trumpocalypse, A Field Guide to the Most Dangerous People in America, written by The Nation's John Nichols. I said it twice, and I got it out the second time, too.
I'm very impressed with you, sir.
I will not go for a third time. John, good to have you on. From PRI, Public Radio International in Los Angeles, I'm Tavis Smiley. It may be some time before we know the true impact of Hurricane Harvey, which left thousands of people in Texas and Louisiana homeless. But those directly affected by the storm are trying to figure out how to rebuild their homes and their lives. Dr. Robert Bullard is known as the father of environmental justice. He is currently a distinguished professor of urban planning and environmental policy at Texas Southern University. He was also evacuated during Hurricane Harvey. He joins us now. Professor Bullard, good to have you on this program, sir. Let me start by asking, how are you and how is your family?
Well, I'm fine and the family's fine. We had to evacuate, but thank goodness I'm back at my home. We didn't get any water. The flood only came up to the street and nothing in the house. So thank goodness I'm okay.
I'm glad you are well. Our hearts, of course, go out to all those who've been damaged in any way, certainly those who've lost lives or lost loved ones in this storm. Let me ask these a couple of uncomfortable, perhaps politically inconvenient questions, but I want to ask them anyway because this is what you do. Give me your sense of what happened in Houston and whether or not what happened there was avoidable, preventable.
I think the idea that the flood and the rain was so intense that given this was a flood of biblical proportions, a lot of the design of the city and the way that our flood protection infrastructure is set up, it has been exacerbated by not having, being prepared to address with this amount of water. The fact that the entire city is flooded and the communities that historically that flooded in the past also flooded, but there are some places that generally don't flood, and so I think we have to plan for making this city, when we rebuild and recover, to make the entire region and the area much more resilient to these kinds of disasters.
Tell me more about what that means, more expressly about how that could have been avoided or what ought to happen in the future to make sure that we don't have the same kind of result.
Well, what we have to do is we have to make sure that when we design and rebuild, that we don't rebuild on inequity. If we talk about this, the city actually not having the same level of protection to avoid the not just the flooding, but also the environmental disaster there are communities that right now that not only have to deal with the floodwaters, but also have to deal with the contamination and the bad air quality and the sediments and residue that's left from all of the vetting of pollution from the industries and fires and explosions, but also the contamination, the chemicals that's left in the water and left in the sediments. Those kinds of contaminations have to be cleaned up, and we have to make sure that we do a better job of not placing certain communities at risk.
You said certain communities at risk. I want to give the title. You've written so many books, but one of them comes to mind immediately. It was entitled "The Wrong Complexion for Protection: How Government Responds to Disasters Endangers African American Communities." Tell me what you were trying to get across in that book, and whether or not Houston is going to be the next exhibit when you put out the next version of this text.
Well, that book was published in 2012, and what we did is to track government response to disasters dating back to the Great Mississippi Flood of 1927 and brought disasters all the way up to the BP spill. The idea that all communities are created equal, we know that's not true. There are some that are more equal than others, particularly when it comes to being in the pathways of natural and man-made disasters. And the idea of how well will government respond to, how well will resources that flow to disaster areas be spent in a way that will make communities whole and not just follow the power, follow the money. We have to make sure that that government does not exacerbate pre-existing inequalities by rebuilding on an inequality. Now, that's what that book dealt with, and those are the lessons in that book, I think, including some of the examples from Hurricane Katrina in 2005, that we have not learned, and I'm hoping that we can do it right this time.
Give me your sense of how hopeful you are that it can be done right this time.
Well, I think the fact, if you look at the television screens, you see all kinds of people being evacuated. You see all parts of the city and the county and the region being impacted by this flood. And I think the message is that there has to be concern for ensuring that we build a healthy, livable, sustainable, and a resilient community that's just, and not just allow the money to flow to where the power is, and money following money. We have to make sure that those communities that were experiencing economic and environmental inequality before the storm are also rebuilt in a way that can make them whole and make them better than the pre-storm conditions that Harvey impacted. Now, that's going to be a challenge, particularly when you have state officials and federal officials somehow that deny, you know, the conditions that may have contributed to the worsening condition of this flooding, namely climate change. And even if we don't, you know, call it climate change, but the fact is that we have to make our cities more climate resilient. We have to make them much more equal in terms of being able to bounce back. And I think this is a great opportunity to do the right thing and to be inclusive, as opposed to allowing those communities that are still in shelters, those residents that are still in shelters, somehow to fall further behind because of lack of resources.
There are two questions that come to mind. Let me ask them in this order. The first question, I suspect, Professor Bullard, is how I should respond when I start getting nasty emails that Tavis Smiley did it again. He had a guest on his show, some guy named Bullard from Houston, and they were turning this disaster into an issue of race. Once again, these Negroes just cannot resist the temptation to turn everything into something about race. Now, I know that you're much brighter than I am, so when I get hit with that, how should I respond to that criticism?
Well, I think you have to tell your detractors that what we're talking about is real. And if you're on the ground, you can see how communities that are impacted are struggling to rebuild and come back. And historically, there are communities that were struggling to rebuild and come back before the storm. There are so many invisible communities right now that are still trying to make themselves visible and heard so that government officials will listen to them and to ensure that their communities are able to bounce back, rebuild, and to enjoy some of the kinds of new birth that will come with Houston coming back and the other cities in Texas coming back and Louisiana coming back. This is real. This is not made up by some radical sociologist.
How can we hope for the best outcomes when, as you said earlier, there are folk on the front side who continue to deny climate change, continue to deny global warming? I'm trying to square those two things, wanting them to do the right thing, wanting the best outcome, the best result of a bad situation, but knowing full well that they don't believe that these factors contributed to it in the first place.
We have to work hard. We have to be determined that this is not a sprint, this is a marathon. Mm. The issues in Houston and Texas and Louisiana impacted by Harvey will not be something that we will resolve next year or maybe in the next 4 years. So that we have to commit ourselves, we have to get young people involved, we have to make sure that people historically that have not been in the room when decisions are made, we have to make sure that they're in the room. We are a very diverse city when it comes to our demographics. We have to make sure that we are diverse when it comes to policy and decision making.
Not to make you political, but Houston has an African-American mayor named Sylvester Turner. Not that New Orleans didn't have an African-American mayor when Katrina hit them. Since you talk so much about politics, can having the right people in the right positions make a difference on these issues?
It makes a world of difference. Having someone that's out front, having an individual that takes charge and takes leadership and the communication information that's being disseminated in terms of daily briefings, in some cases every 2 hours we're getting information, it makes a difference. As when people are in the dark, they don't know what's going on. And I think the fact that having individuals that's in positions to take responsibility and to share the responsibility of working with all kinds of organizations and groups and stakeholders and respecting the wishes and the desires and the priorities of communities. The community leaders and organization leaders have a great responsibility of ensuring that this experiment that we're embarking on will work. And so it doesn't need to be top down. It needs to be involved. It needs to have bottom up. It needs to have lots of individuals in the room. And the people that are most impacted need to definitely be in the room when decisions are being made as to where we, how we rebuild and where we concentrate resources and those kinds of important decisions in terms of planning.
Dr. Robert Bullitt of Texas Southern is known and respected by many of us across this country and around the world as the father of environmental justice, and you're honored to have had him as a guest on this program from Houston. Professor, good to have you on. All the best to you, sir, and you stay strong.
Thank you very much for having me.
From PRI, Public Radio International in Los Angeles, I'm Tavis Smiley. Sheriff Greg Champagne is a member of the national organization Fight Crime, Invest in Kids. The group aims to prevent children from taking a path that could lead to jail time. He tells us more now as part of our ongoing Road to Health series. Sheriff, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Tavis, for having me.
Let me jump right in. Tell me about the program, sir.
Fight Crime, Invest in Kids is a nonprofit national organization. It's a child organization of the Council for a Better America, which has been formed by prominent military, law enforcement, coaches, business people, and it doesn't seek government money. Mm-hmm. What it does, it highlights government programs that truly work to prevent crime and reach out to young children and kids at an early level so that we can get them upstream and try to prevent crime with them and help them be better citizens and live better lives.
What kind of kids are we talking about? Because you hear this phrase all the time, at-risk children. I'm not even sure these days what that means anymore. What kind of kids are we talking about here?
Well, you know, you and I probably had some great parents, you know, mm-hmm. who did a great job with us that we are forever indebted to. And, mm-hmm. you know, and unfortunately, there's some that maybe don't have the quality parents that the rest of us did. So we try to reach out and find those and fight crime, invest in kids. The programs that it urges Congress to support and provide the funding for helps to try and reach those kids, those that have parents that may not be the best parents, that might not understand the difference between, you know, good discipline and mm-hmm. abuse. Mm-hmm. And we find that a lot. And so some of these early mentoring programs, these early childhood programs, can reach these parents and really teach them and help them to practice the skills that parents like you and I had that can help them become mm-hmm. successful adults and crime-free.
Do I take from your answer that you think, or do you have research or data that points to the fact that the majority of this is a parental problem?
I can tell you from 35 years in law enforcement mm-hmm. as a prosecutor and a sheriff that if you show me a bad kid, more often than not, I can show you some parents who didn't really do their job mm-hmm. or weren't able to do their job. So yeah, parenting is a key factor in the success of adult, a young adult.
Yeah. I say this not to demean or cast aspersion on the work, the fine work that you do, but how do you respond to those persons who say that more often than not, law enforcement is the problem?
Well, first off, thank you so much for allowing me to come in here and highlight what is some truly positive work being mm-hmm. done by law enforcement. And you know, the bad situations, the bad incidents, they always make the headline news. Mm-hmm. We all know that. But there is so much good being done by law enforcement agencies, especially the 3,088 sheriffs that I've had the honor of representing in the mm-hmm. past year as their national president. So there are a lot of programs, and we're elected by the public. And if you look at sheriffs, and I'm, again, not to cast any dispersions on police chiefs, mm-hmm. they answer to mayors and city councils. Sheriffs of America are overwhelmingly elected. And so we take that accountability directly to the public very seriously. And I think you'll find, if you go around and look at the sheriff's office like I've done, offices around the country, that there are so many youth programs that they work in, that they implement, things that we need to do to get young kids as they're growing up with sheriff deputies, with police officers, so that these relationships are established at an early age. And I like to use the phrase that we can't grow oak trees without first planting acorns. Mm-hmm. And I think you'll find that some of these programs, Invest in Crime does, these early childhood intervention programs with Work With Parents, kids camps, which many sheriffs, many state sheriffs association do in the summer. One of the cornerstones of my programs, I believe, is that these things put kids with deputies. There's relationships. They know each other in first names. In my parish alone, a parish of 55, which is a county, mm-hmm. parish is a county in Louisiana. I know you're from Gulfport, so you're familiar with us.
I know the
bit.
System down there. Yeah, yeah.
So, and so, you know, 55,000 people, and over the last 20 years, we've put 2,000 teenagers through our annual sheriff's camp in Kiln, Mississippi, mm-hmm. not far from where you're from. And if you think about that, you know, we've got 2,000 kids, some of them now in their 20s and 30s, who know sheriff's deputies in St. Charles Parish on a first-name basis. Yeah. And, you know, it's difficult to have trouble and have conflict yeah. with people when you know them by first name and you've been knowing them all growing up. So, yeah. you know, it's a microcosm of what we hope can spread and be done nationwide. And that's what Fight Crime and Invest in Kids look to do, to promote yeah. programs like this, to hopefully urge Congress to reauthorize the Early Childhood Intervention Program, MCCHEV, which mm-hmm. is up for by September of 2017. That statistics show work. These early intervention programs help parents become better parents. And what it does, it minimizes the chance that these kids are going to get into criminal activities, and statistics show it. Sometimes 50% of these kids that are subject to these volunteer programs where healthcare workers, social workers go in and talk with kids, talk with families, teach families a little more about parenting, mm-hmm. the numbers are really astounding, and they are proof, which is why Fight Crime, Invest in Kids, you know, endorses these programs, because they're statistically shown to work and reduce crime.
This segment is called Road to Health, and you can understand why we wanted to have you on as a part of this conversation, because this is Correct. Clearly about the health of our children, which is about the health of our nation. There are a number of things in the Trump budget that are on the chopping block, including maybe PBS and public radio. He's not a fan of our work. Maybe the answer is because you guys are law enforcement, the president seems to love law enforcement, maybe you're okay. But what sense are you getting about whether or not a program like that, to your own admission, by your own admission, whether the statistics show it works and it works well, what sense are you getting whether or not it's on the chopping block? Because so many programs like this are on the chopping block in this budget.
Well, the programs that Fight Crime, Invest mm-hmm. in Kids endorses, including the early childhood intervention programs that I've talked to you about, they're bipartisan, mm-hmm. and they have traditionally received bipartisan support. And so the whole thing about this, we try to keep it being bipartisan, and not let it get into the mm-hmm. political area, that these are problems that work. I mean, you don't often hear sheriffs and chief of police coming in and saying, let's talk about an early childhood mm-hmm. program, which really doesn't, thank God, it doesn't involve arresting people, mm-hmm. it doesn't involve crime, it doesn't involve drug overdoses, things like that. It's things that we can do upstream that can make our jobs easier, and you know what, make communities safer. So we hope to keep these things into the bipartisan area, which they have been thus mm-hmm. far, and so, we hope Democrats and Republicans alike and the president supports the reauthorization of these early childhood intervention programs in September.
How much of this, Sheriff, you think has to do with fear? And I mean fear on the part of cops, sheriffs, law enforcement, and fear on the part of fellow citizens, because I can show a number of communities across this country, you know this stuff better than I do, where the community is on high alert so often because they are afraid of law enforcement. I can show you places like the South Side of Chicago, the West Side, where the data points out that the police are scared to go into those neighborhoods. So you have a fear problem here where the citizens are scared of the cops are scared of the citizens, and obviously the children are caught in the middle of all of this. What say you about that reality of fear on both sides of the equation?
There's no doubt that in a lot of the major urban centers in the country that does exist. Mm-hmm. And you know, when you see some of the incidents that have been highlighted, been on the top of the news so often, it helps create that fear. So we've got some issues. New Orleans Police Department right now, 600 officers down. A lot of the major cities right now, the big problem is recruiting new police officers mm-hmm. because there are a lot of young people who want to go into law enforcement. They go, do I really want to get into those situations where there is so much hostility? So mm-hmm. you know, it's causing a problem for everybody. And then when we have less police officers in those communities, are not served well and not as protected well as they should be. But I can tell you, come to a lot of the sheriffs, some of the more outside of the urban centers, sheriffs who are elected, you know, we've got to satisfy those public, you know, that those voters come election time. And I think you'll come and you'll find that there might not be so much conflict in a lot of areas around the country. The urban centers do get, you know, the Chicago's and some crime issues in New Orleans also right now, which we're hopefully working on.
I'll put you on the spot here just for a quick second.
Okay.
If you were, just imagine that you're looking at a big audience of young people, children of color specifically, what's your best pitch to them for why they should consider a career in law enforcement, given what many of them think about law enforcement?
I would tell them that this is an honorable profession and that if you truly want to do good for your communities, that this is the place where it can really be done. Mm-hmm. There's no doubt that the completely overwhelming numbers of law enforcement officers are good and dedicated men and women and really are there because it's a calling. And they want to serve their communities. They want to make their communities better. So overlook the high-profile incidences. Come in, see what it's all about. Talk to a law enforcement officer. Talk to a sheriff's deputy. Find out what really drives them. And I think they will find that we'll see some of those that will do it. And we encourage that. That there's nothing better than that, being able to get a more diverse workforce around the country, with both sheriffs and police departments around the country. But give it a try. Don't just listen to what you've seen on the news. Come in and see for yourself and talk to good law enforcement officers and find out what gratification they get from the job. And there is a lot of gratification.
You can make it here in Hollywood. That was very nicely done, Sheriff.
Thank you.
Give me some sense of whether or not in your interplay with these young people, in the work that you do with this organization, whether or not you sense a greater openness on the parts of young girls, young boys, is about the same. I'm just trying to get a sense of how you interact with these audiences and whether or not you pick up on any differences in these groups.
Well, I'm not sure I understand, but in addition to what we talked about summer camps, I mean, I believe, and I think...
There are girls and boys in these camps.
Girls and, well, our camp, unfortunately, is a boys' camp because it's a Boy Scout facility we use. We'd love to find one for the girls.
That's what I was asking
but
you.
Let me tell you, I believe in putting sheriff's deputies out there in any programs, and I've got a list I'd like to get into with, that puts kids with law enforcement officers to where they get to know them, they get to know what they're all about. Like this camp, again. It's all only sheriff's deputies who supervise these kids in this camp going on 20 years. 2,000 kids. We've had several of them become sheriff's deputies in our parish. Now, this is going on around the country. It's nothing that I've got a patent on. And I think we've done it, and I think a lot of law enforcement agencies, especially sheriffs, are really doing it. And so it's an opportunity that we have to see. and cultivate, you know, and again, get those acorns to become oak trees. But it does take time.
I appreciate your work, and good to have you on the program, Sheriff.
Thank you so much,
sir,
for letting me do it.
From PRI, Public Radio International in Los Angeles, I'm Tavis Smiley. Grammy-winning folk legend Judy Collins has recorded over 50 albums. She's also an author, and she joins us now to discuss her latest projects, a book called Cravings, How I Conquered Food, and a CD called A Love Letter to Stephen Sondheim. Judy, good to have you on this program.
Thank you. I'm so pleased to be here.
I thought about you a few months ago when I saw the news of the passing of Leonard Cohen.
Oh. Yeah, we had a 50-year friendship, personal and musical and professional, and it's a terrible loss.
Yeah.
Terrible loss. You know, he came to see me in 1966 to play me. He said, "I can't sing and I can't play the guitar and I don't know if this is a song." And then he sang me, "Suzanne takes you down to her place by the river." That was it.
Yeah.
That was it.
How would you describe his gift? I'm laughing at his comment. I don't do this.
Yeah.
I don't do this. Well, what he did remarkably well.
He did remarkably.
How would you describe his gift?
Well, he was a genius and a monk.
Yeah.
A combination of which is unbeatable, I guess.
Yeah, yeah.
And he never stopped writing great things. Of course, he had intention of stopping. He didn't want to really continue to go out, and he lived, he pretty much stayed up on the mountain, Mount Baldy, outside of Los Angeles, meditating with his guru, his Roshi, and then he lost all his money because his business manager ran off with it in one way or the other. It was gone, and so he had to go back out, and of course that's when suddenly the world knew that they'd finally gotten the chance to go and see Leonard Cohen. He was amazing. And by the way, not just a great artist, but a generous artist, somebody who was a friend of mine in every way. He introduced me to all his best girlfriends that are still, the ones that are still on the planet are still good girlfriends.
Yeah.
That's a sign of a true friend, you know.
Yeah.
And I pushed him onto stage. He didn't want to sing, of course.
Yeah.
And I was doing a big concert at someplace in New York. And I put him on stage. I said, "You have to sing in public because people now know your songs since I've recorded them.
Mm-hmm.
But they want to hear you sing, Suzanne."
Mm-hmm.
And he said, "No, I can't do that. I can't." And he sang, and wonderfully. And from then on, he sang in public.
The rest is history.
Yeah.
You are good friends with Bill and Hillary Clinton.
I certainly
their
have.
Daughter Chelsea is named. You want to tell this story?
Well, I was told by the Clintons when I first met them in 1991, before when he was actually still governor of Arkansas, and they came to see me, and he said, "You know, we named our daughter Chelsea after your version of Chelsea Morning." Of course, I always think that when they see Joni Mitchell, they tell her the same thing because you know.
Because they're the Clintons.
They're diplomats.
No, they're funny. Yeah, they're diplomats. Yeah, exactly. that's funny. This project, A Love Letter to Stephen Sondheim. Tell me about this project.
I discovered Stephen Sondheim. Actually, I didn't know who he was in 1973, and I thought I would have to learn to dance then because Donna Summer was marching up the charts, you know, in her little skirt and her heels. And that was the time when I mentioned that Leonard had introduced me to a couple of his good friends, and his friend Nancy Bacall called me. This was, I don't know, 5 or 6, 7 years after I'd met Leonard. And she said, I'm going to bring you a vinyl, an album of Little Night Music.
What's that?
Oh, yeah. Old fat. You know, we're putting out a vinyl of our new album.
You should, because you know, it's retro. Everybody does it.
Everybody's doing it now. Yeah. This is the hot thing, to have a vinyl record where you can read things and see a picture and learn who's on the CD, on the vinyl.
Mm-hmm.
So she brought me this, and she said, "Now, I want you to play this song." And I put the needle on the cut, and I played Sending the Clowns. And that was, I have letters from him saying, thanks so much for my first top 10 record as a single. And then for about, well, for 25 years, I've wanted to make this mm-hmm. album, this TV special. And finally, PBS, I love PBS. Thank you, God, for PBS. And they gave me the green light, and they said, okay, it's time. And so I recorded it in Colorado with an orchestra, and it was on this spring, and I hope continues to be on PBS.
Oh, trust me, you know how we do it at PBS.
Yeah.
They'll be running it and running it and running it and pledging it and pledging
and
it
that's
and pledging
good.
It.
Yeah. That's good.
It was a wonderful project, and I'm glad you did it.
Thank
you.
You sounded as
lovely as ever.
Thank you.
The most recent project, though, that I'm anxious to talk to you about is this new book, Cravings, How I Conquered Food. And I guess because I've known you over the years, and you've been on the program a number of times, I knew a bit about your past and the drinking and the food and all of that, but I didn't know the extent to which you struggled until I got a chance to get into this text. Tell me about your struggles with food.
Well, they say sugar is the gateway drug.
Yeah, yeah.
And of course, I had a sugar addiction from the time I was very young, as many of us do. Mm-hmm. And it developed into an eating disorder. It was a dance with alcoholism. I mean, they work well together, I must say. one helps the other out, I guess. So for decades, I was back and forth going on various diets, trying to get things together, trying to find out how crazy I was or if I should be locked up or how I could handle this. This is how these things go. These are mental illnesses, by the way. They're not just moral weaknesses. They're really issues that drive you a little crazy. Mm-hmm. And so over the years, finally, I got sober 39 years ago now, which I can't believe. Thank you, God. And then I was able to really deal with the food issue. And over the years, I found a solution, which I write about mm-hmm. in this book. It's very simple. And you know, this diet business in this country is about a $38 billion business.
And growing.
Yeah. And people are always trying. They go, and I've been on all these diets, you know, whether it's Atkins or anybody else.
Let me cut it right quick. What I love about the book, every diet you've ever done, you actually write about in the book.
Yes, I do.
Tell a story about you, which is fascinating.
I do. Yeah. And I also do little biographies mm-hmm. of the diet gurus, starting with, of course, Atkins and Jean Nidich, who started Weight Watcher. Mm-hmm. You know, I called her up when I was writing the book. I called her up in Florida. I found her down there.
Yeah.
She's in a home, was before she died. She sounded like she was like 17 years old. Hi, how are you? Nice to talk to you. Oh, yes, I'm a fan, she said. And I said, well, I'm a fan of you, and I want to know how you knew that you had to have a group, because she started in 1961. She said, well, I was a fat woman with a fat husband and fat friends, and I thought we should all get together mm. and talk about it and mm-hmm. work it through. So I wrote about a lot of diet gurus, and my basic message is, and you do get to the solution here after you go through all mm-hmm. the chapters about my life and about these diet gurus who are fascinating. I even wrote about Tarnauer. Remember Tarnauer mm-hmm. who was shot by his girlfriend? Mm-hmm. I guess his mistress. I don't know what you would call her. They were lovers for a while, and then he left her, and she got mad and shot him. And that's what we remember most about Tarnauer. Not so much his diet. But then I realized the bottom line is grains, sugar, flour, corn, and wheat. Nada. Can't have them. And that's where I got my recovery, because without those things, I don't have any cravings. That's why I called it Cravings, mm-hmm. How I Conquered Food. The other word was how I conquered the food.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah, I got you.
You got me? I mean, it's a struggle.
Can I just say, I have a moment here. We've had to bleep out a number of things over the course of this show. I've never had a guest who self-bleeped. I think that was the first time ever.
Anyway, the main thing is I'm happy, healthy, well, no problems with this. For about 9 years now, I've been completely absent on this particular direction. And I just wanted to share it. I wanted people to know there is hope. It's not this frantic looking for the next book and the next diet and the next, and paying all this money. I did it too.
Yeah.
So that's my hope, that someone will read it and feel that they have a chance to get well too.
Let me talk about the food first. Maybe the alcohol will come up, but on the food front, how did the cravings and the struggle with those cravings, Judy, how did it impact your artistry, your performance?
That's a good question.
Yeah.
I grew up in an addictive family. Mm-hmm. I had alcoholism, some food addiction of some kind. And I also got, in my DNA, I got something a lot of us have. I think I see it in many people. I think you probably have it too. We work. There's a work ethic that goes on no matter what's happening. Mm-hmm. It's a drive. And from the very beginning, when I was 19, I knew I was an alcoholic, but I didn't know what to do about it. You know, mm-hmm. I knew what it meant. It meant I had to drink. Mm-hmm. But I also knew I had to work, and I have always been passionate about what I do. I love what I do. You know, I do 130 shows a year. I travel, I write books, I make records. Because that machinery is in there, in my system. Mm-hmm. And so no matter what I was doing, no matter, well, till the end, and then, you know, the end was I was dying mm-hmm. when I was drinking and couldn't stop. So it finally catches up with you. Mm-hmm. And I think the last 3 or 4 years, everything that I was doing had caught up with me. And even when I got sober, I still had the issue of the food to deal with. Mm-hmm. But, you know, thank God, I got lucky. I found people who knew. I went into treatment for the drinking. But all the while, I mean, when I was in rehab, I'm planning my next record. Yeah. I mean, I don't know when I haven't been planning my yeah. next record. Yeah. It's something that's so wonderful. And in a way, it works. Even when I'm not at my best.
Judy Collins' most recent project is called A Love Letter to Stephen Sondheim. There's a CD and a DVD if you want to get either or both. And her new book is called Cravings, How I Conquered Food. She's a busy woman. You can catch me weeknights on my television show on PBS. For more info on what I'm doing or to hear this show, past shows, or the Tavis Smiley Show podcast, visit TavisSmileyRadio.com. The Tavis Smiley Show is a news and opinion program produced and recorded in Los Angeles by SRP Productions in partnership with Public Radio International. Christabel Nsi Abuadi is our executive producer. I'm Tavis Smiley. This is PRI. Keep the faith.